Well, you will. All in time. Trust me, when you get to that part, you're gonna feel a lot better. That's kind of a turning point, you could say.
Theo lifted his face. The slot at the bottom of the door was still open, showing the tip of a single boot, leather so scuffed it looked white.
Theo, you listening to me in there?
His eyes fixed on the boot with the force of an idea taking hold. Gingerly he rose from the bed and moved toward the door, stepping around the bowl of soup. He sank into a crouch.
Are you hearing my words? Because I am talking about some serious relief.
Theo lunged. Too late. His hand grabbed empty air. A bright explosion of pain. Something came down hard, hard on his wrist. A boot heel. It smashed the bones flat, compressing his hand into the floor, grinding and twisting. His face was shoved against the cold steel of the door.
Fuck! It hurts, don't it?
Spangled motes were dancing in his eyes. He tried to pull his hand away, but the force holding him in place was too strong. He was pinned now, one hand stuck through the slot.
But the pain meant something.
It meant the voice was real.
You go to hell.
The heel twisted again. Theo yelped in agony.
That's a good one, Theo. Where did you think you were? Hell is your new address, my friend.
I'm not your friend, he gasped.
Oh, maybe not. Maybe not just at the moment. But you will be. Sooner or later. You will be.
Then, just like that, the pressure on Theo's hand released. An absence of torment so abrupt it was like pleasure. Theo yanked his arm through the slot and slumped against the wall, breathing hard, cradling his wrist on his lap.
Because, believe it or not, there are things even worse than me, the voice said.
Sleep well, Theo. And then the slot slammed closed. Part 8. The Haven. The aisle is full of noises, sounds, and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about mine ears, and sometimes voices that, if I then had waked after long sleep, will make me sleep again. Shakespeare, The Tempest.
Chapter 47. They had been on the road for hours. With nothing to lie on but the hard metal floor, sleep was all but impossible. It seemed that every time Michael closed his eyes, the truck would hit a bump or swerve one way or the other, sending some part of his body slamming down. He lifted his head to see a glow of daylight gathering beyond the compartment's only window, a small porthole of reinforced glass set in the door. His mouth was bone dry. Every part of him felt bruised, as if someone had been hitting him with a hammer all night long. He rose to a sitting position, pushing his back against the jostling wall of the compartment, and rubbed the gunk from his eyes. The rest of the group were propped on their packs in various postures of discomfort. Though they were all banged up to some degree, Alicia seemed the worst off. She was facing him, her back resting against the wall of the compartment. Her face was pale and damp, her eyes open but drained of energy. Mausami had done her best to clean and bandage Alicia's injured leg the night before, but Michael could tell the wound was serious. Only Amy seemed to be actually sleeping. She was curled on the floor beside him, her knees pulled to her chest. A fan of dark hair lay over her cheek, pushed to and fro by the bouncing of the truck. The memory hit him like a slap. Sarah, his sister, was gone.
He remembered running as fast as he could, through the kitchen and out onto the loading dock and into the street with the others, only to end up surrounded. Smokes everywhere. The street was like a goddamn smoke party. And then the truck with its immense plow driving toward them, spewing its jet of flame. "Get in, get in," the woman on top was yelling at him. And a good thing she had, because Michael had found himself at just that moment paralyzed with fear. Nailed to the ground with it. Hollis and the rest of them were yelling, "Come on, come on!" But Michael couldn't move a muscle. Like he'd forgotten how. The truck was no more than 10 meters away, but it could have been 1,000. He turned, and as he turned, one of the virals locked eyes with him, cocking its head in that funny way they did, and everything seemed to slow down in a way that wasn't good. "Oh, boy," a voice in Michael's head was saying. "Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy." And that was when the woman hit the viral with the flamethrower, coating it with a jet of liquid fire. It crisped up like a ball of fat. Michael actually heard the pop. Then someone was pulling him by the hand. Amy, of all people, whose strength was surprising, more than he would have guessed from the little thing she was, and she shoved him into the truck. Now it was morning. Michael felt himself pushed forward as the vehicle decelerated. Beside him, Amy's eyes shot open. She rolled into a sitting position and drew her knees to her chest once more, her gaze fixed on the door. The truck drew to a halt. Caleb scrambled to the window and peered outside. "What do you see?" Peter had risen to a crouch. His hair was matted with dried blood. "There's some kind of structure, but it's too far away." Footsteps on the roof, the sound of the driver's door opening and closing again. Hollis was reaching for his rifle. Peter put a hand out to stop him. "Wait." "Caleb." "Here they come." The door swung open, blazing their eyes with daylight. Two backlit figures stood before them, clutching shotguns. The woman was young, with dark hair shorn close to her scalp. The man, much older, had a soft, wide face and a nose that looked punched and a few days' growth of beard. Both were still encased in their bulky body armor, making their heads seem strangely undersized. "Hand over your weapons." "Who the hell are you people?" Peter demanded. The woman cocked her shotgun. "Everything. Knives, too." They disarmed, sliding their guns and blades along the floor in the direction of the door. Michael didn't have much more than a screwdriver left. He'd lost his rifle in the dash from the hotel, never having fired the damn thing once. But he handed it over anyway. He certainly didn't want to get shot over a screwdriver. While the woman collected their weapons, the second figure, who had yet to utter a word, kept his gun trained on all of them. In the distance, Michael could make out the shape of a long, low building set against a bulge of barren hills. "Where are you taking us?" Peter asked. The woman lifted a metal pail from the ground and placed it on the floor of the truck. "If you have to piss, use this." Then she slammed the door. Peter slapped the wall of the truck. "Fuck!" They drove on. The temperature was rising steadily. The truck decelerated again, turning west. For a long time, the vehicle bounced violently. Then they began to climb. By now, the air in the cabin had become intolerably hot. They drank the last of their water. No one had used the pail. Peter pounded on the wall that separated them from the truck's cab. "Hey! We're roasting back here!" Time passed, and passed some more. No one spoke. Just breathing was an effort. It seemed that some terrible joke had been played on them. They had been rescued from the virals only to be cooked to death in the back of a truck. Michael had begun to drift in and out of a state that felt like sleep, but not exactly. He was hot. So hot. At some point he realized they were descending, though this detail seemed trivial, as if it pertained to some other person. Gradually the fact seeped into Michael's awareness that the vehicle had stopped. He had been lost in a vision of water, cool water. It was pouring over and through him, and his sister was there, and Elton, too, smiling that off-kilter smile of his. Everyone was there. Peter, and Mausami, and Alicia, and even his parents. They all were swimming in it together, its healing blueness, and for a moment Michael willed his mind to return to it, this beautiful dream of water. "My God," a voice said. Michael opened his eyes to a harsh white light and smell, unmistakable of animal dung. He rolled his face toward the door and saw a pair of figures. He knew he had seen them before, but could not say when. And standing between them, brilliantly backlit so that he seemed almost to hover, a tall man with steel-gray hair, wearing what appeared to be an orange jumpsuit. "My God! My God!" the man was saying. "Seven of them. It's beyond belief." He turned to the others. "Don't just stand there. We need stretchers. Hurry!" The pair jogged away. The thought reached Michael's brain that something was very wrong. Everything seemed to be happening at the far end of a tunnel. He could not have said where he was or why, although he also sensed that this knowledge had abandoned him only recently, a feeling like déjà vu in reverse. It was a kind of joke, but the joke wasn't funny. Not at all. Some large, dry object was in his mouth, fat as a fist, and he realized this was his own tongue choking him. He heard Peter's voice, a labored croak.
"Who are you?"
"My name is Olson. Olson Hand." A smile lit up his wind-chapped face. Only it wasn't the silver-haired man anymore. It was Theo. It was Theo's face at the far end of the tunnel, and that was the last thing Michael saw before the tunnel collapsed, and all thought left him. He did not come to so much as slowly surface, ascending through layers of darkness over a period of time that felt both short and long. An hour turned into a day turned into a year. Darkness yielding to a widening whiteness above him, and the gradual reassembly of consciousness, distinct from his surroundings. His eyes were open, blinking. No other part of him seemed capable of movement, just his eyes, the damp plink of his lids. He heard the sound of voices moving over him like the songs of distant birds, calling to one another across a vast expanse of sky. The thought? Cold. He was cold. Wonderfully, amazingly cold. He slept, and when he opened his eyes again, some unknown interval of time having passed, he knew that he was in a bed, that the bed was in a room, and that he wasn't alone. Lifting his head was out of the question. His bones felt as heavy as iron. It was in some kind of infirmary, white walls and white ceiling, angled beams of white light falling upon the white sheet that covered his body, and beneath which it seemed he was naked. The air was cool and moist. From a place somewhere above and behind came the rhythmic throb of machinery and the drip of water falling into a metal pan. "Michael. Michael, can you hear me?" Seated next to his cot was a woman. He thought it was a woman, with dark hair short as a man's, and a smooth brow and cheeks and a small, thin-lipped mouth. She was gazing at him with what appeared to be intense concern. Michael felt as if he'd seen her before, but his sense of recognition stopped there. Her slender form was draped in a loose-fitting orange costume that seemed, like everything else about her, vaguely familiar. Behind her was some kind of screen, obscuring his view. "How do you feel?" He tried to speak, but the words seemed to die in his throat. The woman lifted a plastic cup from the table by his bed and held the straw to his lips. Water, crisp and cold, distinctly metallic in taste. "That's it. Sip slowly." He drank and drank. How amazing the taste of water. When he had finished, she returned the cup to the table. "Your temperature's down. I'm sure you'll want to see your friends." His tongue felt slow and heavy in his mouth.
Where am I?
She smiled.
Why don't I let them explain that to you?
The woman disappeared behind the screen, leaving him alone.
Who was she?
What was this place? He felt as if he'd been asleep for days, his mind adrift on a current of disturbing dreams. He tried to remember.
Some fat woman. A fat woman breathing smoke.
His thoughts were broken by voices and the sound of footsteps. Peter appeared at the foot of his bed. His face glowed with a grin.
Look who's awake. How are you feeling?
What happened?
Michael croaked. Peter took a seat by Michael's bed. He filled the cup again and held the straw to Michael's lips.
I guess you don't remember.
You had heat stroke. You passed out in the truck. He angled his head toward the woman who was standing to one side, silently observing.
You've already met Billy, I guess.
I'm sorry I wasn't here when you woke up. We've all been taking shifts. He leaned in closer.
Michael, you've got to see this place. It's fantastic.
This place, Michael thought. Where was he? He pointed his eyes toward the woman, her serenely smiling face. All at once the memory coalesced in his mind. The woman from the truck. He flinched, knocking the cup from Peter's hand, sending water splashing all over him.
Flyers, Michael. What's the matter?
She tried to kill us.
That's a bit of an exaggeration, don't you think?
He glanced at the woman and gave a little laugh, as if the two of them were in on some private joke.
Michael, Billy saved us. Don't you remember?
There was something troubling about Peter's good cheer, Michael thought. It seemed completely out of step with the facts. Obviously, he was very ill. He might well have died.
What about Leisha's leg?
Is she all right?
Peter waved this concern away.
Oh, she's fine. Everybody's fine. Just waiting for you to get better.
Peter leaned toward him again.
They call it the Haven, Michael.
It's actually an old prison. That's where you are now, in the infirmary.
A prison? Like a lockup?
Sort of. They really don't use the prison itself much anymore. You should see the size of their operation. Almost 300 walkers.
Though I guess you could say we're the walkers now.
And here's the best thing, Michael. Are you ready?
No smokes.
His words made no sense.
Peter, what are you talking about?
Peter gave a puzzled shrug, as if the question wasn't interesting enough to warrant any real thought.
I don't know. There just aren't.
Listen, he continued, when you're up on your feet, you can look for yourself. You should see the size of the herd. Actual beef cattle.
He was grinning at Michael vacantly.
So what do you say?
Think you can sit up?
He didn't, but something about Peter's tone made him feel that he should at least try. Michael eased himself up on his elbows. The room began to tip. His brain sloshed painfully inside his skull. He fell back down again.
Whoa, that hurt.
That's okay, that's okay. Just take it easy. Billy says a headache's perfectly normal after a seizure like that. You'll be back on your feet in no time.
I had a seizure?
You really don't remember much, do you?
I guess I don't.
Michael breathed steadily, trying to calm himself.
How long was I out?
Counting today? 3 days? Peter glanced at the woman. No, make that 4.
4 days?
Peter shrugged.
I'm sorry you missed the party. But the good news is that you're feeling better. Let's focus on that.
Michael felt his frustration boiling over.
What party? Peter, what's wrong with you? We're stranded in the middle of no place. We've lost all our gear. This woman tried to kill us. You're talking like everything's fine.
They were interrupted by the sound of the door opening and a burst of cheerful laughter. Alicia, on crutches, swung around the screen. Trailing her was a man that Michael didn't recognize. Fierce blue eyes, a chin that looked like it had been chiseled from stone. Was Michael hallucinating? Or were the two of them playing some sort of chase game, like Little's? She stopped abruptly at the foot of his bed.
Circuit, you're up!
Well, look at that, the blue-eyed man declared. Lazarus back from the dead. How you doing, partner? Michael was too startled to respond.
Who was Lazarus?
Alicia turned to Peter.
Did you tell him?
I was just getting to that, Peter said.
Tell me what?
It's your sister, Michael. Peter smiled into his face. She's here. Tears sprang to Michael's eyes.
That's not funny.
I'm not joking, Michael. Sarah's here. And she's perfectly all right.
I just don't remember.
Six of them were gathered around Michael's bed. Sarah, Peter, Hollis, Alicia, the woman they called Billy, and the man with the blue eyes who had introduced himself to Michael as Jude Cripp. After Peter had told Michael the news, Alicia had left to retrieve his sister. Moments later, she had burst into the room and flung herself upon him, weeping and laughing. It was all so completely inexplicable that Michael hadn't known where to begin, what questions to ask. But Sarah was alive. For the moment, that was all that mattered. Hollis explained how they had found her. The day after their arrival, he and Billy had driven back to Las Vegas to look for the Humvees. They'd reached the hotel to find a scene of total destruction, a smoking mound of rubble and twisted girders. The whole east side of the building had collapsed, filling the street with a mountain of debris. Somewhere beneath this lay the Humvees, smashed to pieces. The air was thick with soot and dust. A rain of ashes coated every surface. The fires had leapt to an adjacent hotel, which was still smoldering. But the building to the east, where Hollis had seen the viral taking Sarah, was intact. This, as it turned out, was something called the Eiffel Tower Restaurant. A long flight of stairs led to the structure at the top, a large round room encircled by windows, many broken or missing, that looked out on the demolished hotel. Sarah was curled under one of the tables, unconscious. At Hollis's touch, she seemed to rouse, but her eyes were glazed, unfocused. She appeared to have no notion where she was or what had happened to her. There were scratches on her face and arms. One of her wrists seemed broken from the way she held it, cradling it in her lap. He lifted her into his arms and climbed down the 11 flights of darkened stairs and into the smoke. It wasn't until they were halfway back to the haven that she had started to come around.
"Is that really how it happened?" Michael asked her.
"If he says so."
"Honestly, Michael, all I remember is playing solo. The next thing I knew, I was in the truck with Hollis. The rest is a big blank."
"And you're really okay?"
Sarah shrugged. It was true. Apart from the scratches and the wrist that was not broken after all, but merely sprained, wrapped with a splinted bandage, she had no visible injuries at all.
"I feel fine. I just can't explain it."
Jude twisted in his chair toward Alicia.
"I've got to say, Leish, you sure know how to throw a party. I'd have liked to see the looks on their faces when you tossed that grenade."
"Michael should get some of the credit. He was the one who told us about the gas. And Peter was the one who used the pan."
"I still don't completely understand that part," said Billy, frowning.
"You say it saw its own reflection?"
Peter shrugged. "All I know is it worked."
"Maybe the virals just don't like your cooking," Hollis suggested.
Everybody laughed.
It was all so strange, Michael thought.
Not just the story itself, but the way everyone was acting. As if they had no worries in the world.
"What I don't get is what you guys were doing there in the first place," he ventured.
I'm glad you were, but it seems like quite a coincidence.
It was Jude who answered. We still send regular patrols down to the city to scavenge up supplies. When the hotel went up, we were just 3 blocks away. We've got a fortified shelter in the basement of one of the old casinos. We heard the explosion and headed straight for it. He gave a closed-mouth grin. Just dumb luck we saw you when we did. Michael paused to consider this.
No, that can't be right, he said after a moment.
I remember it distinctly. The hotel blew up after we got out. You were already there.
Jude shook his head doubtfully.
I don't think so.
No, ask her. She saw the whole thing.
Michael turned his head to look at Billy. She was observing him coolly, that same look of neutral concern on her face.
I remember it distinctly. You used the gun on one of them, and Amy pulled me into the truck. Then we heard the explosion.
But before Billy could respond, Hollis broke in. I think you've got it a little mixed up, Michael. I was the one who pulled you into the truck. The hotel was already burning. That's probably what you're thinking of.
I could have sworn.
Michael fixed his eyes on Jude again, his chiseled face. And you were in a shelter, you say? That's pretty much it.
3 blocks away.
About that. An indulgent smile. Like I said, I wouldn't second-guess a stroke of luck like that, my friend.
Michael felt the nervous heat of everyone's attention.
Jude's story didn't add up. That was obvious. Who would leave the safety of a fortified shelter at night and drive toward a burning building? And why was everyone going along with it? The streets on 3 sides of the hotel were all blocked by rubble. That meant Jude and Billy could only have come from the east. He tried to recall which side of the building they'd exited from. The south, he thought.
Oh, hell, I don't know, he said finally.
Maybe I'm not remembering it right. To tell you the truth, the whole thing is pretty mixed up in my mind.
Billy nodded. That's to be expected after a long period of unconsciousness. I'm sure in a few days things will start to come back to you.
Billy's right, said Peter. Let's let the patient get some rest. He directed his voice to Hollis. Olson said he'd take us out to the fields to look around, see how they do things.
Who's Olson? Michael asked.
Olson Hand. He's in charge around here. I'm sure you'll meet him soon. So, how about it, Hollis?
The big man offered a close-lipped smile.
Sounds great. With that, everyone rose to leave. Michael had resigned himself to lying in solitude, puzzling over these strange new circumstances, when at the last instant Sarah darted back to his bedside. Jude was observing her from the edge of the screen. Taking hold of Michael's hand, she kissed him quickly on the forehead. The first time in years she had done this.
I'm glad you're okay, she said. Just focus on getting your strength back, okay? That's what we're all waiting for.
Michael listened closely for their departure. Footsteps, then the sound of a heavy door opening and closing again. He waited another minute to be certain he was alone. Then he opened his hand to examine the folded slip of paper Sarah had secreted there.
Tell them nothing.
Chapter 48. The party Peter had spoken of had been held the previous evening, the 3rd night after their arrival. This had been their one chance to see everyone, the whole of the Haven, in one place. And what they saw did not ring true. Nothing did, beginning with Olson's claim that there were no virals. Just 200 kilometers to the south, Las Vegas was crawling. They had traveled at least that far from the Joshua Valley to Kelso, through similar terrain, and the virals had followed them the whole way. The stink of that herd, Alicia pointed out, would travel far downwind as well. and yet the only perimeter appeared to be a metal fence, far too insubstantial to protect against an attack. Except for the flamethrowers on the vans, Olsen had confessed, they had no useful weapons at all. The shotguns were just for show, all of their ammunition having been used up decades ago. So you see, he had told them, our existence here is an entirely peaceful one. Olsen Hand. Peter had never met anybody like him, so apparently at ease with his own authority. Apart from Billy and the man known as Jude, who seemed to function as his aides, and the driver of the truck that had brought them from Las Vegas, Gus appeared to be a kind of engineer in charge of what they termed the physical plant. Peter could detect no other structures of command. Olsen had no title. He was simply in charge. And yet he wore this mantle easily, communicating his intentions with a gentle, even apologetic manner. Tall and silver-haired, like most of the men, Olsen wore his hair in a long ponytail, while the women and children were all closely shorn, with a stooped frame that seemed to barely fill his orange jumpsuit and a habit of placing the tips of his fingers together when he spoke. He seemed more like a benevolent father figure than someone responsible for the lives of 300 souls. It was Olsen who had told them the history of the Haven. This had transpired within the first hours of their arrival. They were in the infirmary where Michael was being attended by Olsen's daughter Mira, an ethereal, slender-limbed adolescent with close-cropped hair so pale and fine it was almost transparent, who seemed to regard them with a nervous awe. After they had been carried from the van, the seven of them had been stripped and washed, their belongings confiscated. All would be returned, Olsen had assured them, except for their weapons. If they chose to move on, and here Olsen had paused to note with his customary mildness that he hoped they would elect to stay, their weapons would be returned to them. But for now their guns and blades would remain locked away. As for the Haven, a lot was simply not known, Olsen explained, the stories having evolved and changed over time until it was no longer clear what the truth really was. But a few points were generally agreed on. The first settlers had been a group of refugees from Las Vegas who had come there in the last days of the war. Whether they had come by design, hoping that the prison, with its bars and walls and fences, might offer some safety, or had simply stopped here on the way to someplace else, no one could know. But once they realized there were no virals, the surrounding wilderness being too inhospitable, forming in fact a kind of natural barrier, they had chosen to remain and eke out an existence from the desert landscape. The prison complex was in fact made up of two separate facilities. Desert Wells State Penitentiary, where the first settlers had housed themselves, and the adjacent conservation camp, a low-security agricultural work camp for juvenile offenders. That was where all the inhabitants now lived. The spring from which the prison took its name provided water for irrigation, as well as a steady stream of water to cool some of the buildings, including the infirmary. The prison had provided much of what they needed, right down to the orange jumpsuits nearly everyone still wore. The rest they scavenged from the towns to the south. It was not an easy existence, and there were many things they lacked, but here at least they were free to live their lives without the threat of the virals. For many years they had sent out search parties to hunt for more survivors, hoping to lead them to safety. They had found some, quite a few in fact, but not for many years, and had long since given up hope of ever finding any more. Which is why, Olsen had said, smiling benignly, your being here is nothing less than a miracle. His eyes actually misted it over. All of you. A miracle. They had spent that first night in the infirmary with Michael and were moved the next day to a pair of adjacent cinder block huts on the outskirts of the work camp, facing a dusty plaza with a pile of tires in the center, the edges lined by fire barrels. This was where they would spend the next 3 days in isolation, a mandatory quarantine. On the far side were more huts, which appeared to be unoccupied. Their quarters were Spartan, each of the two huts with just a table and chairs and a room in the back with cots. The air was hot and dense, and the floor crunched underfoot with grit. Hollis had left with Billy in the morning to look for the Humvees. Working vehicles were in short supply, Olsen had said, and if they had survived the explosion, they would be worth the hazards of such a trip. Whether Olsen intended to keep them for his own use or return them, Peter did not know. This fact was left ambiguous, and Peter had elected not to press. After their experience in the van, the seven of them nearly cooked to death in the heat, and with Michael still unconscious, the wisest course seemed to be to say as little as they could. Olsen had questioned them about the colony and the purpose of their journey, and there was no avoiding offering some explanation. But Peter had volunteered only that they had come from a settlement in California and had gone looking for survivors. He told Olsen nothing about the bunker, his silence suggesting that the place they came from was well armed. There would come a time, Peter thought, when he would probably have to tell Olsen the truth, or at least more of it. But that time had not arrived yet, and Olsen had appeared to accept the caginess of his explanation. For the next 2 days they received only fleeting glimpses of the other inhabitants. Behind the huts stood the growing fields, with long irrigation pipes radiating from a central pumphouse, and beyond that the herd, several hundred head kept in large shaded pens. From time to time they could see the boiling dust of a vehicle moving against the distant fence line. But apart from this, and a few figures in the fields, they detected virtually no one. Where were the other people? The doors to their huts were not locked, but always across the empty plaza were two men wearing the orange jumpsuits. It was these men who brought them their meals, usually in the company of Billy or Olsen, who reported on Michael's condition. Michael appeared to have lapsed into a deep sleep. Not a coma, necessarily, Olsen assured them, but something like one. They had seen it before, they said, the effects of the heat. But his fever was down, a good sign. Then the morning of the third day, Sarah was returned to them. She possessed no memory of what had happened to her. This part of the story that they related to Michael when he awakened the following day was not a lie, nor was Hollis's tale of how he had found her. They were very happy and very relieved. Sarah seemed fine, if a little slow to come around to the news of their new circumstances. But it was also true that both her capture and her return were deeply puzzling. Like the absence of lights and walls, it simply made no sense. By this time, whatever happiness they felt at the thought of finding another human settlement had been replaced by a deep unease. Still, they had seen almost no one, apart from Olsen and Billy and Jude, and the two orange-suited men who watched them, whose names were Hap and Leon. The only other sign of life was a group of four littles in raggy clothing who appeared each evening to play on the tires in the square, though strangely no adults ever appeared to claim them. They simply drifted away when the game was over. If they weren't prisoners, why were they guarded? If they were, why all the pretense? Where was everyone? What was wrong with Michael? Why was he still unconscious? Their packs, as Olsen had promised, had been returned to them. The contents had obviously been examined, and a number of items, such as the scalpel in Sarah's medkit, had been taken. But the maps, which Caleb had tucked into an inner compartment, had apparently been overlooked. The prison itself was not on the Nevada map, but they found the town of Desert Wells, north of Las Vegas, on Highway 95. It was bordered to the east by a vast gray region, no roads or town in it at all, marked with the words, Nellis Air Force Test Range Complex. Situated at the western edge of this region, just a few kilometers from the town of Desert Wells, was a small red square and the name Yucca Mountain National Repository. If Peter was correct about where they were, they could see this structure plainly, a humped ridge forming a barricade to the north. Hollis's drive south with Billy and Gus had given him the chance to scout out more of the landscape. The fence line, Hollis reported, was more robust than it appeared. Twin barricades of heavy gauge steel, roughly 10 meters apart, topped with concertina wire. Hollis had seen only two exits. One stood to the south, at the far edge of the fields. This seemed to connect to a roadway that encircled the compound, and the main gate which connected the compound with the highway. This was flanked by a pair of concrete towers with observation posts. Manned or not, they didn't know, but one of the orange-suited men was stationed in the small guardhouse at ground level. It was he who had opened the gate for Hollis and Billy to pass. The haven itself was situated just a few kilometers off the highway that had carried them north. The original prison, a forbidding bulk of gray stone, stood at the eastern edge of the compound, surrounded by a few smaller buildings and Quonset huts. Between the perimeter and the highway, Hollis said, they had crossed railroad tracks running in a north-south direction. These appeared to head straight toward the ridge of mountains toward the north. Odd, Hollis noted, because who would run a pair of tracks straight into a mountain? In their first meeting, Olson had mentioned a railroad depot in response to Peter's question about where they got fuel for their vehicles. But on the drive south, Hollis said, they hadn't stopped, so he couldn't say if there was a fuel depot or not. Presumably they got fuel somewhere. It was only in the course of this conversation that Peter realized that the idea of leaving was already taking shape in his mind, and that this would require stealing a vehicle and finding fuel to run it on. The heat was intense. The days of isolation had begun to take their toll. Everyone was antsy and worried about Michael. In their stifling huts, none of them was sleeping. Amy was the most wakeful of them all. Peter didn't think he'd seen a girl close her eyes. All night she sat on her cot, the features of her face gathered in what appeared to be intense concentration. It was as if, thought Peter, she was trying to work out some problem in her mind. On the third night, Olson came for them. Accompanying him were Billy and Jude. Over the preceding days, Peter had come to suspect that Jude was more than he had first appeared to be. He couldn't say why this was, exactly, but there was something disconcerting about the man. His teeth were white and straight, impossible not to look at, like his eyes, which radiated a piercing blue intensity. They gave his face an ageless quality, as if he had slowed time, and whenever Peter looked at the man, the impression he received was of someone who was looking straight into a gale of wind. Peter had become aware that he had yet to hear Olson give the man a direct order. Olson addressed himself entirely to Billy and Gus and the various orange-suited men who came and went from the hut, and in the back of Peter's mind the idea had begun to form that Jude held some measure of authority, independent of Olson. Several times he had observed Jude speaking to the men who were guarding them. In the falling dusk, the three appeared across the square, striding toward the hut. With the day's passing heat, the littles had appeared on the tires. As the three passed by, they abruptly scattered, like a flock of startled birds. "It is time to see where you are," Olson said when he reached the door. He was smiling munificently, a smile that had begun to seem false. It seemed like a smile with nothing behind it. Standing next to Olson, Jude was showing his line of perfect teeth, his blue eyes darting past Peter into the dim hut. Only Billy seemed immune to the mood. Her stoic face betrayed nothing. "Please come, all of you," Olson urged. "The wait is over. Everyone is very excited to meet you." They led the seven of them across the empty plaza. Alicia, swinging on her crutches, kept Amy close to her side. In watchful silence, they moved into a maze of huts. These appeared to be arranged in a kind of grid, with alleyways between the lines of buildings, and were obviously inhabited. The windows were lighted with oil lanterns. In the spaces between the buildings were lines of laundry, stiffening in the desert air. Beyond, the bulk of the old prison loomed like a cutout shape against the sky. Out in the dark, no lights to protect them, not even a blade on his belt. Peter had never felt so odd. From somewhere up ahead came a smell of smoke and cooking food and a buzz of voices, growing as they approached. They turned the corner then to see a large crowd gathered beneath a wide roof that was open on the sides and held aloft by thick steel girders. The space was lit by smoky flames from the open barrels that encircled the area. Pushed to the side were long tables and chairs. Jumpsuited figures were moving pots of food from an adjacent structure. Everyone froze. Then, from the sea of faces gazing at them, first one voice and then another rose in a buzz of excitement.
"There they are! The travelers! The ones from away!"
As the crowd enfolded them, Peter had a sense of being softly swallowed, and for a brief time, subsumed in a wave of humanity, he forgot all about his worries. Here were people, hundreds of people, men and women and children, all so apparently joyous at their presence he almost felt like the miracle Olsen had said they were. Men were clapping him on the shoulder, shaking his hand. Some of the women pressed babies to him, displaying them as if they were gifts. Others merely touched him quickly and darted away. Embarrassed or frightened or merely overcome by emotion, Peter couldn't tell. Somewhere at the periphery of his awareness, Olsen was instructing people to stay calm, not to rush, but these warnings seemed unnecessary. "We're so happy to see you," everyone was saying. "We're so glad that you have come." This went on for some minutes, enough time for Peter to begin to feel exhausted by it all, the smiling and touching, the repeated words of greeting. The idea of meeting new people, let alone a crowd of hundreds, was so new and strange to him that his mind could scarcely capture it. There was something childlike about them, he came to think, these men and women in their threadbare orange jumpsuits, their faces careworn and yet possessing a look of wide-eyed innocence, almost of obedience. The crowd's warmth was undeniable, and yet the whole thing felt staged. Not a spontaneous reaction, but one designed to elicit the very response it had produced in Peter. A feeling of complete disarmament. All of these calculations were moving through his mind, while part of him was also struggling to keep track of the others, which proved difficult. The effect of the crowd's advance had been to separate them, and he could detect only quick glimpses of the others. Sarah's blonde hair peeking above the head of a woman with a baby over her shoulder. Caleb's laughter coming from somewhere out of range. To his right, a nugget of women had encircled Mausami, cooing with approval. Peter saw one dart out her hand to touch Mausami's stomach. Then Olsen was at his side. With him was his daughter Mira. "The one girl, Amy," Olsen said, and it was the only time Peter had ever seen the man frown. "She can't speak?" Amy was standing close to Alicia, ringed by a group of little girls who were pointing at Amy and pressing their hands to their mouths in laughter. While Peter watched, Alicia lifted one of her crutches to shoo them away, a gesture half playful and half serious, sending them scattering. Her eyes briefly met Peter's. "Help," she seemed to say. But even she was smiling. He turned to Olsen again. "No."
"How strange. I've never heard of that."
He glanced at his daughter before returning his attention to Peter, looking concerned.
"But she's otherwise... all right."
"All right?" He paused.
"You'll have to forgive my directness. But a woman who can bear a child is a great prize. Nothing is more important with so few of us left. And I see that one of your females is pregnant. People will want to know."
"Your females," Peter thought. A strange choice of words. He looked toward Mausami, who was still surrounded by the women. He realized that many of them were pregnant, too.
"I suppose." "And the others, Sarah and the redhead, Leash."
The line of questioning was so odd, so out of the blue, that Peter hesitated, unsure of what to say or not say. But Olsen was looking at him intently now, requiring at least some kind of response.
"I guess."
The answer seemed to satisfy him. Olsen concluded with a brisk nod, the smile returning to his lips.
"Good."
Females, Peter thought again. as if Olson were speaking of livestock. He had the disquieting sense of having told too much, of having been maneuvered into surrendering some crucial bit of information. Mira, standing beside her father, was facing the crowd, which was moving away. Peter realized she hadn't said a word. Everyone had begun to gather around the tables. The volume of conversation settled to a murmur as food was passed out. Bowls of stew ladled from giant vats, platters of bread, pots of butter, and pitchers of milk. As Peter scanned the scene, everyone talking and helping themselves, some assisting with children, women with babies bouncing on their laps or suckling at an exposed breast, he realized that what he was seeing was more than a group of survivors. It was a family. For the first time since they had left the colony, he felt a pang of longing for home, and wondered if he had been wrong to be so suspicious. Perhaps they really were safe here. And yet something wasn't right. He felt that, too. The crowd was incomplete. Something was missing. He couldn't say what this missing thing was, only that its absence, nibbling at the edge of his consciousness, seemed more profound the longer he looked. Alicia and Amy, he saw, were with Jude now, who was showing them where to sit. Standing tall in his leather boots, nearly everyone else was barefoot, the man seemed to tower over them. While Peter watched, Jude leaned close to Alicia, touching her on the arm, and spoke quickly into her ear. She responded with a laugh. These thoughts were interrupted when Olson rested his hand on Peter's shoulder. "I do hope you choose to remain with us," he said. "We all do. There's strength in numbers." "We'll have to talk about it," Peter managed. "Of course," said Olson, leaving his hand where it was. "There's no hurry. Take all the time you need." Chapter 49. It was simple. There were no boys. Or almost no boys. Alicia and Hollis claimed they'd seen a couple. But when Peter questioned them more closely, they were both forced to confess that they couldn't say for sure if they'd seen any or not. With those short haircuts all the littles wore, it was difficult to tell, and they'd seen no older children at all. It was the afternoon of the fourth day, and Michael was finally awake. The five of them had gathered in the larger of the two huts. Mausami and Amy were next door. Peter and Hollis had just returned from their trip out to the fields with Olson. The real purpose of this trip had been to get a second look at the perimeter, because they had decided to leave as soon as Michael was able. There was no question of taking this up with Olson. Though Peter had to admit he liked the man and could find no outward reason to distrust him, too much about the Haven simply failed to add up, and the events of the night before had left Peter more uncertain than ever of Olson's intentions. Olson had given a short speech welcoming them all, but as the night had worn on, Peter had begun to find the crowd's empty warmth oppressive, even disturbing. There was a fundamental sameness to everyone, and in the morning Peter found he couldn't recall anyone in particular. All the faces and voices seemed to blur together in his mind. Not one person, he realized, had asked a single question about the colony or how they'd come to be there, a fact that the longer he considered it, made no sense at all. Wouldn't it be the most natural thing to wonder about another settlement? To question them about their journey and what they had seen. But Peter and the others might just as well have materialized out of thin air. No one, he realized, had so much as told him their name. They would have to steal a vehicle. On this point, everyone was agreed. Fuel was the next question. They could follow the train tracks south, looking for the fuel depot, or if they had enough, drive south to Las Vegas to the airport before heading north again on Highway 15. Probably they'd be followed. Peter doubted Olson would let go of one of the vans without a fight. To avoid this, they could head straight east instead, across the test range. But with no roads or towns, Peter doubted they could make it. And if the terrain was anything like it was around the Haven, it didn't look like the kind of place where they wanted to get stranded. This left the matter of weapons. Alicia believed there had to be an armory somewhere. From the beginning, she'd maintained that the guns they'd seen were loaded, no matter what Olsen said. And she'd done her best to feel out Jude on this question the night before. Jude had stayed close to her all evening, just as Olsen had stayed close to Peter, and in the morning he had taken her out in a pickup to show her the rest of the compound. Peter didn't like it, but any chance to glean more information, and to do so in a way that would go undetected, was one they had to take. But if there was an armory, Jude had given no hint where it might be. Perhaps Olsen was telling the truth, but it wasn't anything they could risk. And even if he was, the weapons they had brought with them had to be somewhere. By Peter's count, 3 rifles, 9 blades, at least 6 magazines of ammunition, and the last of the grenades.
"What about the prison?" Caleb suggested.
Peter had already thought of this. With its fortress-like walls, it seemed the natural place to lock something away. But so far none of them had been close enough to see how they might get inside. For all intents and purposes, the place seemed abandoned, just as Olsen had said.
"I think we should wait till dark and scout it out," Hollis said. "We can't know for sure what we're up against if we don't."
Peter turned to Sarah. "How long do you think until Michael can travel?" She frowned doubtfully.
"I don't even know what's wrong with him. Maybe it really was heatstroke, but I don't think so."
She had expressed these misgivings before. Heatstroke serious enough to make him seize, Sarah had said, would almost certainly have killed him, because it would have meant the brain had swollen. His protracted state of unconsciousness might follow from that, but now that he was awake, she detected no sign of brain injury at all. His speech and motor coordination were fine. His pupils were normal and reactive. It was as if he had fallen into a profound but otherwise ordinary sleep from which he had simply awakened.
"He's still pretty weak," Sarah went on. "Some of that is just dehydration. But it could be a couple of days before we can move him. Maybe more."
Alicia sank back on her cot with a groan.
"I don't think I can keep this up that long."
"What's the problem?" Peter asked.
"Jude is the problem. I know we're supposed to play along here, but I'm wondering how far I'm going to have to take this."
Her meaning was plain.
"Do you think you can, I don't know, hold him off?"
"Don't worry about me. I can take care of myself. But he's not going to like it."
She paused, suddenly uncertain.
"There's something else. Nothing to do with Jude. I'm not sure I should even bring this up. Does anybody remember Liza Chow?"
Peter did, at least by name. Liza was old Chow's niece. She and her family, a brother and her parents, had all been lost on Dark Knight. Killed or taken up, he couldn't recall. Peter remembered Liza vaguely from their days together in the sanctuary. She was one of the older children, practically an adult in his eyes.
"What about her?" Hollis asked.
Alicia hesitated.
"I think I saw her today." "That's impossible," Sarah scoffed. "I know it's impossible. Everything about this place is impossible. But Liza had a scar on her cheek, I do remember that. Some kind of accident, I forget what it was. And there it was. The same scar."
Peter leaned forward. Something about this new bit of information seemed important, part of an emerging pattern his mind couldn't quite discern. "Where was this?"
"In the dairy barns. I'm pretty certain she saw me, too. Jude was with me, so I couldn't really break away. When I looked again, she was gone."
It was conceivable, Peter supposed, that she had escaped and somehow ended up here. But how would a young girl, as Liza was at the time, travel such a distance?
"I don't know, Leish.
Are you sure?"
"No, I'm not sure. I didn't have the chance to be sure. I'm just saying she looked a lot like Liza Chow."
"Was she pregnant?" Sarah asked. Alicia thought for a moment. Come to think of it, she was. A lot of the women are pregnant, Hollis offered. It makes sense, doesn't it? A little is a little. But why no boys? Sarah went on. And if so many of the women are pregnant, wouldn't there be more children? Aren't there? Asked Alicia. Well, I thought so, too. But I didn't count more than a couple dozen last night. And the children I see all seem to be the same ones. Peter said, Hollis, you said there were some kids outside. The big man nodded. They're playing on that pile of tires. High top, check it out. Caleb rose from his bunk and moved to the door, opening it a crack. Let me guess, Sarah said. The one with the crooked teeth and her friend, the little blonde girl. Caleb turned from the door. She's right. That's who's out there. That's what I mean, Sarah insisted. It's always the same ones. It's like they're always out there so we think there's more than there are. What are we saying here? This was Alicia. Okay, I agree it's strange about the boys. But this... I don't know, Sarah. Sarah turned to face Alicia, squaring her shoulders combatively. You're the one who thinks she saw a girl who died 15 years ago. She'd be, what, in her mid-20s now? How would you know it was Liza Chow? I told you. The scar. And I think I know a Chow when I see one. And that means we're supposed to take your word for it? Sarah's sharp tone seemed to bristle through Alicia. I don't care if you do or not. I saw what I saw. Peter had heard all he wanted to. Both of you, enough. The two women were glowering at each other. This isn't going to solve anything. What's the matter with you? Neither woman answered. The tension in the room was palpable. Then Alicia sighed and flopped back on the cot again. Forget it. I'm just tired of waiting. I can't sleep at all in this place. It's so goddamn hot I have nightmares all night long. For a moment, no one spoke. The fat woman, Hollis said. Alicia sat up quickly. What did you say? In the kitchen. His voice was grave. From the time before. Caleb stepped toward them from the door. I tell you, the boy isn't just dumb. Sarah finished for him. He's been struck dumb. Her face was astonished. I'm dreaming about her too. Everyone was looking at Peter now. What were his friends talking about? What fat lady? He shook his head. Sorry. But the rest of us are having the same dream, said